continue our conversation about John Hick, we'll pick up where we left off last time. And where we left off last time was on page 612. So I'll back up a little bit to review that at the risk of being a little bit repetitive and boring. And then we'll pick up again on page 613. And I hope by the end of this talk, you'll understand why I'm emphasizing Hick on a more organic level than just on the basis of what I had said at the very beginning about why it is. So basically where we ended up was with the problem, roughly speaking, described as the blind man or blind men and the elephant, which is, if we're looking at the problem of religious pluralism, so we have multiple religions, and if we're content to just say they're multiple religions and that's all there is to it and we don't want to know anything more about it, then it doesn't make any difference. But if we're interested in what's going on in those religions and religious life of the people that are adherents of those religions, then we have a different sort of problem, and it's described as the problem of the blind men and the elephant, which is, oh, we thought we'd lost you with the plague, whatever
that
plague is going
late.
On. Oh, okay, well, I'll remember that. So, in this class anyway, we're interested in looking at different religious traditions and trying to understand them in relationship to each other. And that's the way we're approaching the issue of pluralism. And it's not a matter of this one's good and that one's bad. It's a matter of what's going on. Because in the study of religion, we could look at the sociology of religion, which is how do societies organize themselves with religious values. Or we could look at the literature of religion and understand religions that way, or the anthropology of religion or something like that. But I'm going to be following in this class the approach that Houston Smith takes in his own work in comparative religion. And in the Religion 102 class that I teach, which is World Religions, we use the Smith textbook, where he really tries to look at what is the essential thing going on in these different religions around the world. And he has a reason for doing this. And he does this before we had such a pluralistic society. He does this because, in his view, all these different religions are functional pathways to the ultimate reality. We'll take care of that, okay? In an academic sense, basically it's sort of like saying if we had an anthropology class, we might study a lot of different cultures, and is there something about all those cultures that are similar that tells us something about the human experience as embodied in culture? And if we look for those similarities, maybe we can find something about the human experience. So if you extrapolate from that to what we're doing here in this class, which is on what is religion, right? We're looking at religious life in many environments or through many dispensations or however we want to describe it, and say, what is it about religion that's common in human experience? What does it tell us about being a human being, more importantly? And if I could venture to say it, based upon that, is there anything there that helps you understand yourself as a human being? Because going to college is pretty useless, as far as I'm concerned, if you don't walk out of the college experience knowing more about yourself than before you walked into it. I mean, it's true, college is, you know, about preparing for a job and finding your place in the world and all that stuff. And I don't discount that. That's important. But college is also about learning about yourself, I think. So hopefully we give you some environment of stuff here to learn about yourself through what we're studying. I guess that was my billboard for the day, right? But, you know, I have to go over these kinds of things because when we're teaching religious studies in a public university, there's always the question of what are we doing here? There's always the question of what are we doing here? I mean, there was a performance of monks from a Tibetan monastery at Mackenzie Hall about 7 years ago, which I organized, actually. And it was a cultural performance. But they were monks. They came out of a monastic environment. But in Tibet, culture is religious culture. And they were doing various dances and songs and chants and things like that. The people who organized that on campus got mail from the community that was angry. What are you doing having this religious performance in a public university? Well, what we're doing is we're saying there are different ways to be culturally religious in the world, and we're showing you one of those ways. There are many other ways, and we show you those ways too. And so now you know something about the rest of the world. But that's not the way it was viewed by everybody. So I have to constantly be making this point. And so pardon me if I make it ad nauseum. You know what ad nauseum means. It means if I sicken you with it. Okay, back to the point. Let's jump to page 613. And as I've indicated, when I talk about a paragraph, I'm talking about full paragraphs. So if we go down 1, 2, 3, 4 paragraphs that begins as these questions indicate, we need a pluralistic theory which enables us to recognize and be fascinated by the manifold differences between the religious traditions. With their different conceptualizations, their different modes of religious experience, and their different forms of individual and social response to the divine. I should like in these final pages to suggest the ground plan of such a theory. And that's what he's going to do. Now, it's curious to me that he says, a pluralistic theory which enables us to recognize and be fascinated by. I'm not sure why he uses the word fascinated by. I mean, recognize, I understand. He certainly isn't saying, you know, try and practice or to do something like what Eck refers to as having our own personal braided religiosity, where we combine in some way different religious traditions and our own personal life. He's not talking about that. So I'm not quite sure what fascinated means. Maybe he's such an intellectual that reading scriptures from other religions gets him high or something. I don't know. I mean, really rings his bell. Doesn't do that for me. Looking at religious art and listening to religious music does that, but not reading scriptures. That just really, so that's just my nature. Okay. So anyhow, he's going to try and create this this theory, and that's the point, because I want to look at what his idea of a theory would be. So first off, in the next paragraph, he says, in the middle of the paragraph, the ultimately real and the ultimately valuable are one. So that's the first thing. Okay. So in this, he's merely reminding us that what is considered the ultimate truth of things in all different religions do have something in common. They're ultimately valuable. They really matter. So if you're a Muslim, it really matters about your faith because your eternal soul depends on it. If you're a Buddhist, the nature of the ultimately real really matters, because if you don't get that sorted out, you get reborn over and over and over again in this world. And some people might think being reborn in the world is pretty cool. I knew a lot of people in California when I was a young man who thought, reincarnation, that's great. I get to come back over and over again. The Buddhist view of that was, I don't know, you might end up in a slum in Buenos Aires. It may not be so good. Or, you know, you may be a fly that gets munched by a spider over and over again. Or, I mean, there are all kinds of possibilities in the Buddhist world. And they didn't necessarily think that continued rebirth was necessarily a good thing. It could be an okay thing, but it wasn't necessarily a good thing. So this idea of what's the ultimate good is not always totally obvious. But anyhow, the ultimately real is connected with the ultimately good. So if we're going to understand other peoples and what their values are, really is what it comes down to, we have to know what the ultimate good is for them. And that's connected to the ultimate real, the ultimately real. If you want to understand the Muslims down the block, you need to know what they think about ultimate truth, because that's going to determine what they want out of their lives and how they live their lives. That's really what it boils down to in a simplistic sense, even though he doesn't say that. Further on in this paragraph, he says, further, each tradition is conscious that the divine reality exceeds the reach of our earthly speech and thought. It cannot be encompassed in human concepts. Now we're really getting into something very meaty here. And it has many aspects to it. What Hick is saying is that pretty much every religious tradition tells us that what's ultimately real, and therefore ultimately valuable, is incomprehensible because it can't be embodied in speech. It can't be encompassed in speech, he uses this language. So this is a very interesting idea, because we pretty much naively, well, maybe that's not fair, we pretty much natively think whatever's out there that we want to know about, we can have a certain concept and a certain way of knowing about it. Even if it's a mathematical concept, you know, how do you talk about the relationship of matter and energy? E equals mc squared. It's an equation. It's mathematical. But it is a concept that we use to understand that reality. And words are just other concepts that we use to understand that reality. And if you really think about it, so are images, like paintings, simply a type of concept for understanding that reality. And so is music, and so is dance. And in all religious traditions, we have these expressions which point at the ultimate. Hick is saying they can't ever do anything more than point at the ultimate, reference the ultimate. And pretty much all those religious traditions say the same thing. For example, in Islam, it is not even conceivable that you would try and create an image of Allah. It's even forbidden to create an image of a human being in general, although that particular tradition is sometimes broken. Nobody would try to make a painting of what Allah looks like. Now, there are praises of Allah which are ornamented and embellished and made beautiful, and looking at them might give you some sort of spiritual experience, might connect you with God. But no Muslim would ever say that somehow God is in that, because God must extend way beyond that, because no conceptuality can hold God. And pretty much every tradition will say this. Now, maybe this is apocryphal, which is to say, who knows if it's true or not. That's what apocryphal means in this case. But presumably, I've been told, that the best Muslim weavers, when they weave a rug, they will weave a perfect rug and then intentionally put a mistake in it. Right. Is this true or not? I don't know. The story goes that only God can make a perfect anything. And so if I make a perfect rug, I'm acting godlike, not permitted. Right. So I'll put an intentional mistake in there someplace so it's not perfect. It expresses something, whether or not it's true, I don't know. All right, but the important thing is no language, no words, no concept will actually be able to do anything more than point at the ultimate. So now you can see we're going to have a problem in the study of religions, because the best we're going to ever get to is a kind of representation that refers to something else. Can we open this door, do you mind? Because I think some cross-draft will. I don't know about you, but I get hot standing up here. Okay, so we have the problem of conceptuality and language articulated here as part of the pluralistic issue, part of the process of creating a pluralistic vision. We need to understand this. That's what I'm trying to say. Okay, if we move on to the next paragraph that begins, "Let us next adopt." Well, I'll just read the first line. "Let us next adopt the distinction that is to be found in different forms and with different emphases within each of the great traditions." And here's the point. "The distinction between the real on sikh," which means in him, her, itself, he's being very general here, "in itself, and the real as humanly experienced and thought." So he's just going a step farther with the idea that conceptuality can't reach the ultimate. But what he's saying is it's in our nature as human beings that there is reality, whether that's God or whatever else you want to say it is, in itself. And then there is what we can experience. And there's a difference between the two. Now, right away, that's very interesting to establish a pluralistic theory on that basis, because there are plenty of religious practitioners who would disagree right away. They'd say, no, it is possible to experience God directly. Okay. and to know God directly, or to know the ultimate directly. In fact, that's the whole point of religious life. So he seems to be creating kind of a problem here, but in his way of understanding things, human experience is small and divine experience is large, and it's not possible for those two things to come together. Now, that's a pretty common view, and it's not just Hick's view. I'm going to go back to Islam again. And I like to use Islam as an example because it's a theistic tradition, but it's not the Christian tradition. Right? So it's outside of our native experience, and therefore it's kind of more interesting to look at it. So in Baghdad, I think it was, might have been another part of the Middle East, about 1,000 years ago, there was a great saint, a Sufi, somebody who practices his personal relationship with God, who was deeply, deeply revered in the community. I think this was in Baghdad. Viewed as a holy man, no question about it. He made a mistake when he was in an ecstatic state, in a trance, which is to say that he was experiencing God directly in his body, in his mind. What he was experiencing was no separation between himself and God. And we'll talk more about how that might be possible when we go to India starting tomorrow and into the next few days. We'll talk about how Indians understand how this could be possible. There are Sufi ways of explaining this, but I'm not going to get into that. I don't really have the expertise and whatnot. Anyway, that's not the point. He's experiencing this, and in that state, he says, An al-Haq. That's Arabic for I am the one. I am God. It is me. Something like that. I'm not translating it very well, but you get the idea. In the ecstatic state, it was like God through him is saying, I'm God. I'm it. Unfortunately, he said it in the presence of a whole lot of other people. And the caliph had a problem. Because in conservative Islam, he was doing something that was a big problem. Because in the Muslim tradition, God is up there, he's transcendent, and we're down here in the world, and God has let us know what we're supposed to do here in the world through his messenger Muhammad. End of story. To say, I am God, I am him, I am it, is the most blatant form of heresy. And so the caliph had a problem. He was beloved as a saint, but he had committed the ultimate sin. They crucified him as a result of this. They executed him, right, in spite of this. So that's not the point. Well, I mean, I guess it is a point in a certain way. But the point is that in many religious traditions, there was no pun intended in that. I don't know how they crucified him. In many religious traditions, the idea that one can merge fully with God is not only deemed possible, but deemed desirable. Right? So Hick has kind of gone off in his own way here. That's the point I want to make. But from an intellectual point of view, we can understand this. Certainly, from the point of view of being a Christian, we can understand this. Now, let's move on. Let's move on to page 614. Second paragraph, in the middle of the paragraph. He says, the central fact of which the epistemology of religion also has to take account is that our environment is not reflected in our consciousness in a simple and straightforward way, just as it is independently of our perceiving it is. Okay, so epistemology, if you don't know what that means, epistemology means the study of what's knowable. It's a field of philosophy. It's actually, I think now probably reasonably you could say it's also a field of psychology, but traditionally it's a field of philosophy. It's the theory of what is knowable and what is not knowable. And it's pretty dense stuff, but I actually think it's pretty interesting if you get into it, at least on a civilized level. So what is he saying here, and why is this important? He's saying the central fact about the epistemology of religion, the epistemology of religion has to take into account, which what we're doing here is really the epistemology of religion, if you think about it. So the central fact we have to take into account in this class is that our environment is not reflected in our consciousness in a simple and straightforward way. In other words, We make a representation of the environment. That's what we experience. Okay. When I'm looking at that tree out there, which is now a little bit yellow because it's early fall and green, and I see that and the light shining on it and so on and so forth, I natively look at that and I think, I'm looking at a tree. There's a tree out there. But if we think about what we know as educated human beings from studying biology and physics and so on and so forth, we know that actually what's happening in my experience is there is presumably a tree out there, but light bouncing off of those leaves and passing through my glasses and the retina of my eye, excuse me, the lens of my eye, and then landing on the retina of my eyes is then formed into an image because of my immense experience as a human being in this life and what I've learned in education and culture and language, and I recognize that as a tree. Now, what I experience is light. I don't experience the physical thing that's out there. I experience the light bounced off it. So right away, it's a representation. It's like a movie. You know, you go to the movies, there's a screen, light's projected on it, then you see the Hulk or whatever else is going on in the movie you're watching. The Hulk is not on the screen. Light is on the screen. But you really get into the experience of the Hulk being on the screen and you forget about the fact it's just light on a screen. And you form a relationship with the Hulk as if the Hulk is real. And when he bursts out of his clothes and goes, grr, you have a reaction, right? Otherwise, the movie's no fun. Okay. So what makes life fun, I guess we're saying, is that we forget that there's no tree there. There's just light. But really, if you think more deeply about this epistemology, the deeper thing is not just that we create a concept of a tree. The deeper thing is that we create a concept of the tree, that actually what we're experiencing is not even the light. We're experiencing a combination of the light, our thoughts, our cultural experience, the word tree, all the emotional history we have about the fall when we look at the tree. It's not free from that emotional history. I look at trees turning yellow in the fall, and I think of things like stacking firewood, storm windows, being sure I have a snow shovel. I can't just look at a tree and see a beautiful tree. I see all the work I have to do. You know, other people look at trees and maybe what they think of, skiing season is on the way, you know. But we don't just see a tree. That's my point. There's a whole lot of other stuff going on. That's Hick's point too, though, that with all the concepts that are associated with religion, right, there's just not a straightforward thing that's going on. Something is mediated. Moreover, if you go down the way this plays out, which is particularly relevant farther down in this paragraph, is he's talking about the divine reality. Maybe I'll back up here. This all-important dimension of meaning, which begins at the physical level as the habitability of the material world, that's what I've been talking about with a tree, continues at the personal or social level of awareness as the moral significance of the situations of our life, and at the religious level as a consciousness of the ultimate meaning of each situation and of our situation as a whole in relation to the divine reality. This latter consciousness is not, however, a general consciousness of the divine, but always takes specific forms. So what that means is that in our life, in culture, we can't approach the divine in anything other than in a fashion that's been formed by our cultural experience, that's inescapable. And this is a very important point for Hick. What it means is that just as I can't really experience the tree in itself, I can't experience God as God is. That, for one thing, I can only experience kind of a mediated version of God, which we've already talked about. But more than that, the mediated version of God that I experience is shaped by my culture. So if I'm somebody that's born in a Christian culture, I'm going to tend to view God as personal. Maybe in the back of my mind there's this image of Jesus and the little children and the sheep or something like that. that I can't get away from that sort of thing. But more significantly, if I'm a Buddhist, my view of the ultimate reality doesn't look like Jesus and little sheep. And if I'm a Christian who's interested in Buddhism, then the question is, how do I get to the place of experiencing what Buddhists are talking about, minus the little sheep? And can I do that? Because religious experience always happens situated in a culture. And Hick is going to say, nope, you can't. You can never get rid of the little sheep if you're a Christian. Now, Ramakrishna is going to say that's not true, by the way. It's one of the reasons we're going to study him. But Hick's pluralism says it is true. So what does this mean when Eck is talking about people who have a braided spirituality? What are going to be the limitations of their spirituality? What is that going to look like? How is that possible? Any takers about the limitations? Okay. If no takers, I'll go on. Sure, Alex.
Having a braided view, is that what you mean?
Right.
Having a braided view would be like, yes, you are this essential piece of the hair, but by intertwining with other pieces, you're still that same piece, but you're intertwining with other religions while keeping your own personal views.
And how would that facilitate having a religious experience, or facilitate reaching that ultimate good which is associated with that specific religious character of the strand of hair that you are, to use your own metaphor?
Because the essential of braiding is making three become one, but those three are still three.
Good point.
And so when you take in a religious view, you are still yourself, but by intertwining with those other religions, you become more than just yourself.
Right. So a rope, just to follow this idea out, a rope is made strong by the many strands that are braided together. So perhaps we could say that our religious sentiment is made stronger by being braided with other kinds of religious sentiment. Mm-hmm. If we were to say that, then we'd be in the Dalai Lama's camp, interestingly. Because although he says the ultimates of all these different religious traditions are different and unknowable to practitioners, the ultimate of religion A is unknowable to the practitioner of religion B. But he says it's very important for followers of religion A and B to know about each other and their ultimates. And why is that? Because they in some way enrich one's understanding of religion in general, and by doing so, that strengthens one's faith in one's own religion, which is a good thing because of the moral outcomes from all of that. So that's sort of a conclusion we could draw from your response to the braiding. Okay. All right, back to consciousness. This latter consciousness of the divine reality is not general, but takes specific forms. So Muslims have their own way of experiencing divine reality, Buddhists have theirs, and their specific forms. The forms matter. They have limitations, but what Hick doesn't say is they also have power. Because if you're deeply enmeshed in the form of a religion, it has the power to transform you. And if you're not deeply enmeshed in that form, it has less power to transform you. I'll give you an example, and then we'll get to Forrest with your question. I'm not a sports fan. So as time goes on, you're going to get used to my weird analogies, metaphors, and stories. I'm not a sports fan. But there was a time in my life when I used to go to a lot of baseball games with my dad because he was elderly and I wanted to form that kind of relationship with him. And we lived in San Francisco, and so he went to see the Oakland A's play a lot because he lived in the East Bay. It was easier. We could get there on BART. All right, side issue. So if you go to a baseball game, I mean, if you really want to get into the game, apart from enjoying the hot dogs and all that kind of stuff, it's like you got to really care about your team. You know, people get really enthusiastic about their team. And if you really believe, because you're from Oakland, that the A's and somehow represent the virtues and the spirit of your city, when they win, you have a really wild experience. And I saw a lot of that. I saw people jumping up and down and having a great time. You know, it's like so-and-so hit a home run, or basically, you know, uh-oh, we're losing. Uh-huh. Oakland sucks, you know, that kind of thing, and everyone's unhappy. Well, I'm just sort of sitting there, and I'm thinking, wow, I get to sit here with my dad. Isn't that nice? He's an elderly man, and isn't that cool? He's not going to be alive much longer. I didn't give a toot about the baseball game. So what happened? So my experience was sort of like neutral. It wasn't a very, you know, I mean, in regards to the baseball game, it was sort of neutral. The people all around me are having a great time, all right? Now, my point is, when the form, like, you know, being attached to the team, the home team, when the form is alive and vital, it motivates you, it energizes you. So one of the downsides of people who take a pluralistic view in regards to their own religion, even though they follow through with this idea of it's important to know about other religions and to have these conversations, and that it can strengthen your faith by understanding similarities and differences and whatnot. There's also a downside and a dangerous side, which is it can weaken your sense of attachment to your own forms because you see them as not ultimate. You see them as, well, they're kind of given because I live in a Christian culture and because I can't have a direct experience, as Hicks says. So therefore, yeah, okay, so, you know, Jesus on the cross, well, that's a nice symbol of something. It's not like I'm having an emotional reaction anymore to the sacrifice of the Lord. So that's a downside to it, and there is a downside to it. Okay, you're following all of this. Forrest, yeah, your question.
Is Hick trying to say that if you're a spiritual person that isn't tied to a religious institution, that you can't really have large, like, big spiritual experiences?
He's not saying it about being tied to a specific religious institution like the church. But he is saying that in regards to being tied to a religious tradition that reflects your own culture and circumstances. So it's not like you have to be a Catholic and your religious experience is mediated by the church in some way. And if you don't have a relationship with the church, you're not going to have a religious experience. What he's saying is that as a Westerner, you're going to more likely have a certain kind of relationship with religious life that's compatible with a Western style of religion than if you become a Confucian. That is what he's saying, as far as I can see it, which not everybody is going to agree with, by the way. We're just sort of, you know, at Hick here. But I do think it's true that natively there are certain religious traditions that kind of fit the way we think about things. For example, as Americans, we have a certain idea about what constitutes an individual, a person, and the virtues of individuality, which are very different than, say, a Japanese would have. I mean, one of the virtues in Japan is cooperation and community. It's not like that's not a virtue in the United States, but the quality of individuality, which is a virtue in the United States, would probably in many cases be viewed as a vice in Japan. And the qualities of community in Japan might be viewed as a vice to some degree in the United States. We would call it groupthink, right? Or sort of, you know, social control or mass-mindedness. We have all kinds of words to describe that, but in Japan, a lot of this might be understood as being part of a larger community and felt like we feel like it's a good thing. Now, why that's important is, as Hick has pointed out, part of what happens in religious experience is individual-centeredness gives way to reality-centeredness. Remember this? So it's not like the Japanese are not individuals. They are. But they're a different kind of individual. They have a different sense of their individuality. Therefore, what's needed in Japan for individuality to give way to individual-centeredness to give way to reality-centeredness is different than what's needed in the United States for individual-centeredness to give way to reality-centeredness. that being the case, the mechanisms or tools or whatever the case may be, or concepts or practices that are required to get the job done for Americans are different than what are required to get the job done for Japanese. And if you think it's not true, talk to anybody my age who went to live in a Zen monastery in the 1960s or 70s. It was a shock. It was a shock to be there and what that life was actually like. You know, I didn't do that, so I'm not saying that's out of personal experience. But it was a life that was geared for transforming Japanese experience in a certain way, not American experience. And so when Zen Buddhist teachers came to the United States to teach Zen, they had to figure out how to do it because they couldn't do it in the way it was done in Japan. And there are all kinds of stories from the 60s and 70s of Zen masters who came to the United States and got it wrong, and the consequences of getting it wrong. Like simple things, like Americans aren't used to sitting cross-legged. So there's a tradition in Japan of doing something called a sesshin, which is at least a 1 week long meditation retreat where you're basically sitting cross-legged from the time you wake up in the morning until the time you go to sleep at night, including when you take your meals. Well, so Americans tried to do that and developed all kinds of cases of sciatica, which were then hard to cure because we're not used to sitting cross-legged that way. Well, Japanese didn't have that. They had other problems, but they didn't have that problem. It's like, and that's a simple case. Not even to talk about the social, cultural, emotional, sexual, you know, other stuff that happened. Okay. Well, we might be going on until tomorrow. We might run out of time. Okay. So, where were we here? Okay. So all this stuff happens in specific ways. That's what we were talking about. Okay, now, let's go on down to the last paragraph on this page, 614. How are these various specific forms of religious awareness formed? Our hypothesis, that is to say, Hick's hypothesis, is that they are formed in the presence of the divine reality. This presence coming to consciousness in terms of the different sets of religious concepts and structures of religious meaning that operate within the different religious traditions of the world. Now, here he's saying something that really is profound. He's saying all these forms that I've described to you as being very limited and limiting and so on and so forth, where they came from is a meeting of the divine reality with the limitations of human experience. In other words, although they're limited and shaped by culture, their origin, from Hick's point of view, is God or ultimate reality. And why is he saying this? How could I have an image of the tree out there unless there was a tree out there to have an image of? The image of the tree and the tree are not the same thing. But in my mind, I'm not going to be able to formulate an image of a tree unless there's a tree out there. Otherwise, I have a hallucination. I know there are people who think that religion is a big hallucination. But assuming that they're wrong, okay, what Hick is saying is that all these limited concepts come from the meeting of our limited mind and culture with the ultimate reality. And the ultimate reality, in a sense, reveals itself in these different forms. So in that sense, they're very important and viable. So these forms are double-sided, if you will. It's like a double-edged sword. They have limitations on the one hand, but they open into reality, divine reality, on the other hand. Therefore, they're vehicles for understanding the ultimate good. And that's why they're important in different religious traditions. So then, where does that lead us? Well, it's going to lead us, just to sort of give a preliminary, it's going to lead us to the idea of they all work. They're all valuable. One is no more valuable than another, necessarily, and therefore deserving of respect. So Hick's pluralism is a pluralism of all these things are true. Limited, but they open on to the truth. All these religious traditions are true, limited in their own way, but they open on to the truth. So I repeated that because it's important. Okay. Moving on down the line here on this page, 614, toward the very bottom, he says, there are two basic religious concepts which between them dominate the entire range of the forms of religious experience. One is the concept of deity or God, i.e., the real as personal, and the other is the concept of the absolute, i.e. the real, as non-personal. The term absolute is by no means ideal for the purpose, but is perhaps the nearest that we have. We do not, however, in actual religious experience, encounter either deity or general or the absolute in general, but always in specific forms. He goes back to this idea again. But here's the point of this statement. And this may be a concept that's new to you, possibly because you come out of a Christian background. There is this idea in all religions that God is like a person. But how many of you knew that there was this idea in many religions that God is not like a person, that God has no personal aspect at all? Anybody? Didn't know that. Okay. In most Asian religions, God is not personal. Now, how can we have a God that's not personal? That's something that many people will find mysterious. God is like a person. He has personal characteristics. We even say he. Maybe it'd be better to say she. Ramakrishna would say God, she. Okay. But the idea that we have God it or God that, that's impersonal. But if you really look at all the different religious traditions, what you find is that there are personal readings of the ultimate and there are impersonal readings of the ultimate. And surprisingly, if you look in every given religious tradition, although Hick doesn't say this, you find both. In fact, if you look in Christianity, which you generally think of as having a personal reading of God, you can find impersonal readings of God. If you look at the theologians, the Christian theologians of the Middle Ages, they talked about something they called Godhead. Godhead means the divine ground of reality, which is not personal in character. But they're Christians. They're Christian theologians. They didn't even get in trouble with the church very much. Okay. And if you go to Buddhism, which you would see, generally speaking, as an impersonal religion, you have all these Buddhas floating around. They look pretty personal. Go to Hinduism. Thousands of gods. The Hindus say God, the ultimate, takes so many forms, we're not going to limit that. How many do you want? 100,000? A million? Doesn't matter. We're not going to limit God. God can take any form he wants. So who's God? Brahma, Vishnu, Shiva, those are like the ultimate forms of God? Uh-uh. Brahman is the ultimate form of God. And what's Brahman? Existence, knowledge, consciousness. Sat, Chit, Ananda, they say. None of those things is personal. So in the Hindu view, the impersonal can take personal form. Because how could you limit God? Why would you say that you limit God to being personal or impersonal? God can be anything God wants because he's God or it's God. So how can you limit God? Right? Well, okay, so you find these in all the traditions, but it's important to hold this distinction that there is personal and impersonal form of God. And different religions view these two things together. Okay. Back to this paragraph at the top of 615. For there are different concrete ways of being human and of participating in human history. And within these different ways, the presence of the divine reality is experienced in characteristically different ways. So that's just reiterating, finally, this thing about even though God is not limited, the experience that you'll have of God is limited by your own cultural thing. Okay, so it's now 1:45. And I wanted to get into this material on page 616 and 617, but actually I wanted to get into all of it. And so we don't have time to do that, because it's really the concluding issue. So I thought that we'd be finished with Hick today and we'd go to India tomorrow. So tomorrow we'll start out with Hick, and then halfway through the hour, then we'll go to India. Okay? Sounds good? And yeah, now, I talked a lot. If you have questions, bring them tomorrow. Hopefully, I won't spend the whole term just talking a lot. That's not very interesting to anybody. Especially in the hour after lunch. So.
It seems like an hour.